When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Warning. This episode of the Dom Harvey podcast may be upsetting to some listeners or viewers. It centres around terminal illness and assisted dying. Please listen with caution. This is the Tracy Hickman story.
With further medication and treatment, I could probably be around for a while longer. But I don't just want to exist. I don't just want to live. And I don't want to have to deal with the pain and the incontinence and not being able to travel and all the other stuff that goes with it. I've lived a very full life, and that's the term. I only want to live that sort of life. And if I can't do that, I want out.
In March 2019, Tracy, an ultramarathon runner and accountant, went for a routine mammogram and was hit with the devastating news she had an aggressive type of breast cancer. Tracy and I met at the Boston Marathon in 2023, where she was running despite battling cancer. You would have no idea she was sick unless she told you, nor would you ever see her without a smile. Relentlessly positive would be a perfect way to describe her. Recently, Tracy asked me if we could do this podcast, and it was a privilege. Tracy's story is not just about her battles with cancer or the marathons that she's run across all seven continents. It's a larger story of relationships, love, and legacy, and also an opportunity to shine a light on assisted dying, a subject that she believes deserves more coverage and open conversation. From my perspective, I'd like to think this episode is a celebration of Tracy Hickman's undeniable fabulousness, her wit, warmth, and willingness to discuss topics that are often shrouded in silence. At the very least, I hope this makes all of us appreciate what we have and to make the most of today, because you never know what tomorrow may bring. This is the Dom Harvey Podcast, and this is the Tracy Hickman story. Hello, Jessica. Welcome to my podcast. Tracy, that was an inside joke. We caught up yesterday. I texted you and I called you Trace. It's a thing I do. I abbreviate people's names. And you loathe Trace.
I do. I hate. There's only a couple of people who call me Trace who get away with it. One of them, because he's always called me Trace, and I should have corrected him in the early stages and I didn't, so I let him get away with it now. But most people who know me would never go there.
Mm. The Jessica thing, you said to me Jessica was your preferred name.
Yeah, so when I was younger, I had a cat that I called Jessica. I had a VW Beetle that I called Jessica. I had a computer that I called Jessica. I wanted to be Jessica. And for a little while, I had one boyfriend and he called me Jessica and I kept ignoring him. It was like, well, look, you know, if you're going to be called Jessica, you've got to actually react to the name. So I gave up on that.
Yeah, I love the juxtaposition between the trivialness of this and what you're dealing with at the moment. I think it's really cool. It's cute. So first of all, let's open with a bit of context. So you're currently very, very unwell.
Yeah.
You've got terminal cancer, and you've executed your right to die, and you're gonna die on May 22nd, which is about 3 weeks from now.
So it's I've met two doctors who've both said that I am eligible for executing the right, and I've got a meeting later today with the first doctor again. She's the one who's going to be actually helping me make it happen, and I just need to check with her that 22nd works for her as well. As long as it does, then 22nd will be the date.
Yeah, so you and I know each other through running. We don't know each other particularly well, though. But we were in Boston in April last year for the marathon, and I had no idea you were sick. You ran last year, eh?
Yes, I did. So I had cancer 5 years ago, and went through treatment, and pretty much, you know, I never felt it was completely over, but I'd got back to running marathons again. I did my first 100 kilometres was after I'd been through cancer treatment. And then I did another 100 kilometre race in Australia, the Ultra Trail Australia. And I wanted to do the six marathon majors. I'd got four of them out of the way. And I was entered to do Tokyo in March last year. and Boston in April last year. And those had been entered like for a year. And I started to get ill in the October of 22. And I kept being told it was migraine. And I thought, well, that's not going to stop me running a marathon. So I carried on with all the plans to travel to those two. I actually got diagnosed with the cancer coming back in the middle of February last year. So I knew it was back when I did Tokyo. So I ran Tokyo Marathon. At that time, I had two tumours in my spine. And we thought that that was going to be the extent of it. But then just before I flew to Tokyo, we found out I also had tumours in my lungs and in my chest wall, and that it was wider spread than we thought. So I was going to need to go through chemotherapy again. So I ran Tokyo. And then I flew to the UK to see my family. And we had a little holiday in Italy to go to Cinque Terre to go and see, so, you know, these beautiful terraces for 5 nights with my family. And then I flew to Boston and I ran the Boston Marathon. And I pretty much knew it was going to be my last marathon. I knew it was going to get me my 6 majors. I didn't know if I could finish the race because I had a lumbar puncture just before I flew. Mm-hmm. And that was really painful flying. And I didn't know, we knew it was spreading quickly. I didn't know whether I'd be able to just, you know, actually do the run. But I did and finished the marathon. And that was, it was a wonderful marathon. It was really lovely doing it with people who were special to me. And yeah, and I remember running down the finishing chute crying, thinking, this is the last time I'm ever going to do this. But it was okay. What a one to finish on. And then really bizarre. So I worked 10 years for Abbott Laboratories, who sponsor the World Marathon Majors. I worked for them in Germany for 10 years. And the people giving the 6-star medals were all Abbott employees. And the woman who gave me the medal, she said something. And I said, oh, are you German? And she was German. We'd worked together in Germany. When I worked in Germany, how bizarre is that? So she gave me my medal, and I'd worked with her in Germany in the German Abbott offices.
Crazy. It's remarkable. Yeah. Hey, just get that microphone a little bit closer to your face. For anyone that doesn't know what you're talking about with the World Marathon Majors, it's a series. There's 6 of them, right? So there's New York, London, Boston, Chicago, Berlin and Tokyo.
Yeah.
And I'm a 6-star finisher. Once you've done all 6 of them, you get this big giant medal, which is an ugly piece of silverware, but it's very, very expensive.
It's big. It's big. It's impressive. Yeah.
So, you and I are in a group of maybe 400 New Zealanders, I don't know, yeah, that have got these medals. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah,
it was an exciting achievement. And it was, so it was, I got back from doing the marathon on the Friday. I remember landing at 6 a.m. and at 10 a.m. I was in the scanner having a CT scan. And then on the Monday, the chemo started. So it was straight into it.
Wow. And you're a tough bitch as well.
Yeah.
Like you told me you told me yesterday. We'll unpack the whole Tracy Hickman story. But you told me yesterday that your pain level at the best is a constant 4 out of 10.
Yeah.
For you to say 4 out of 10, for a normal person that would be excruciating because with the running stuff you've done, and it's a remarkable journey, especially since you're quite a late starter. You started sort of middle. You know,
I was 40-ish. 42 yeah, when I did my first marathon.
So I think it's just worth mentioning this because your ability to cope with pain and even put yourself in the pain cave is incredibly high.
Yeah.
It's a high bar. First of all, May 22nd, 2024, if everything goes exactly the way you hope, how will that day look?
It will hopefully have some chocolate for breakfast because I'm a real chocoholic and I'm not going to miss out on that. And then we're going to go to a beach with the people I really love, with my sister and her husband, my niece, my partner, and a few close friends. And I'm going to listen to the waves, see the sea, and I will die. And I just feel such a huge relief that I'm going to be able to do it in that way. It's going to be a very gentle way to die. It's the minimum amount of pain that I could have, to, you know, in order to achieve that. Somewhere beautiful. Hopefully I'm online going to have a few close friends and family as well. I'm originally English. And there are people in the UK who aren't able to come and make the trip, but I'm hoping to have them online. And I feel I've been given this massive gift. I feel privileged. In the last few months, I have said goodbye to so many people. How many people get a chance to do that when they pass away? And so, yeah, just feeling very fortunate to be in the position that I'm in, and that in New Zealand we have the ability to do this. It's been very interesting over the last week to find out some people don't even realise that it is legal here. And I know it's up for review at the end of the year, and I'm very much hoping it gets renewed. But yeah, it's a really, really privileged.
Mm. What attracted you to exiting on your own terms? You're a control freak?
An absolute control freak. And the side effects from the treatment have been horrendous. You know, particularly in the last year, I'm not the person I was, and I don't want to just with further medication and treatment, I could probably be around for a while longer. But I don't just want to exist. I don't just want to live. And I don't want to have to deal with the pain and the incontinence and not being able to travel and all the other stuff that goes with it. I've lived a very full life. I'm very fortunate with what I've been able to do. And that's the term. I only want to live that sort of life. And if I can't do that, I want out. And I spent time looking at how I could do it. I don't want to commit suicide, because I don't want to do it in a way that would have an impact on other people. You know, if someone commits suicide, it's awful for the people around them. And, yeah, just not a road I want to go down. Another way to do it would be to voluntarily stop eating and drinking. And that's not something I want to do. I think when people naturally come towards the end of their life with cancer, they'll lose their appetite. But it's not a comfortable way to go. It's not a quick way to go. And it's not a way that I want my family to see me go. So this way feels like a gentle way, and a way that none of us want it to happen. But I think everyone is supportive of me being able to make the choice. And everybody realizes that it's the right thing for me. And over the last 2 or 3 weeks, since I've sort of been making the decision, I feel so much better. I just feel really comfortable that this is the right choice for me. And everybody who knows me, who's aware of it, has also said, yep, they can see the change in me. They can see that I've just reached a level of peace.
That's a lot to take in.
It is. Sorry, it's confronting. And I'm really comfortable with it. I've talked about it a lot, so I can talk about it without being in floods of tears. I'm sorry if have an impact on you. If you need a hug, Chef.
I came around to your place yesterday. We caught up yesterday and you told me the date. And I found that quite, confrontational, I guess. And I started
I'm hoping now it is going to be that date. Yeah. And I've got a problem if it isn't, because it seems like half my family have got birthdays in May. And so do it on someone's birthday. So I've had to make a list to work out what the dates I can't do it. There's not that many left, so...
All right. Okay. We'll go back further, and then we'll do a full circle, and we'll cover the stuff off again. But first of all, who is Tracy Hickman?
Yeah, who am I? I'm sitting opposite you. I'm 57 years old, originally from the UK. Lived in New Zealand for 20 years. Do you want me to talk about my childhood a little bit? It was a really shit childhood.
That's interesting, in particular. Like the Trace that I know, it's you're a tough bugger, you're very stubborn. I know this by some of the running events you've done, which are just wild, and we'll get into that. And you were a late starter to the sport. So reflecting on your early years, like, where do you think that comes from?
I think because it was rough. My father was a gambler. He was a lovely man, but he was very weak, and he was a gambler. And my mother had some awful mental health issues. She was not a lovely woman. She used to leave every few months, and it was a really rough childhood. And it culminated in, when I was a teenager, my dad had left, so I was just living with my mum, and one day I got home to an empty house. My bedroom was intact, and there was one of everything in the kitchen, but she had taken everything else, even the light bulbs, completely empty. She'd moved out, and here I was just suddenly by myself. So I started flatting. I found somewhere to live. I got myself a job and gave up any hope of going to university at that stage, and just got a job and worked and got over it, got on with my life. But I think all of that has given me strength to know I can get through anything, I can survive anything. And over the years, I was very lucky. I got into an accounting career, and that ended up being quite a nice lucrative career, so that gave me the freedom to do lots of things. I've worked with some wonderful people. I'm still in touch with people I worked with in my first job nearly 40 years ago.
Yeah, that was at Hasbro, right?
Yes, yeah, the toy company. And it was 1985, which is when Transformers and My Little Pony were released.
Yeah, it was the heyday of Hasbro.
Oh, incredible, incredible.
So you were uneducated, but you got this job.
I was an accounts assistant.
Rose through the ranks, but you were sort of out of your depth.
Oh, I was way out of my depth, but we all were. None of us really knew what we were doing, because we suddenly, you know, this tiny little company, I can't remember what the turnover was in the first year, but it sort of was 10, 15 times in a year. And, and that set me off on my career path. So that was incredible. And then I moved to work for Abbott Laboratories, the big multinational healthcare company. And I worked for them in the UK, and my mother was German, so I could speak German. And our finance director went to work in Germany. So a little while after we'd been there, I got a call saying, hey, do you want to come and work over here? And that moved me to Germany. And I had a wonderful 10 years working over there and really enjoyed living there. But while I was working for him, I had the opportunity to apply for some jobs, and I didn't get them because I didn't have the qualifications. And so that set me off on a path. I moved to Cardiff, went to Cardiff University in Wales, got myself a degree. And then I got my accounting qualification, and that set me up then for a proper career in accounting. So, yeah, I was 27 when I went to uni, went as a mature student, but I lived with a whole load of 18-year-olds. They used to call me Auntie Tracy, and had a great time with them. I sort of rediscovered. I think those teenage years that I'd missed out on because I was busy just trying to survive, I had that when I was 27, getting drunk at the pub and getting Doc Martens and, you know, all that sort of stuff. That was fun. And then I met my husband and we got married and we moved to New Zealand.
Yeah, Invercargill.
Invercargill.
Why?
Yeah, I know.
Why? You love doing tough things, don't you?
People diss Invercargill, but I think a lot of people who say nasty things about it haven't actually been there. It's not that bad a place. And it was a good place to start life in New Zealand. I had a good job. I'd taken a step back and had an easier job because I didn't want it to be all about work. I wanted to enjoy life. We were lucky. We sold our house in the UK and bought a house without a mortgage. So that gave a certain amount of freedom to be able to take a step down. And I learned to snowboard, did kayaking, just had a lot of outdoor life, really enjoyable time. But my husband and I, we had a lovely marriage, but I don't think it was ever meant to be for the whole of our lives, and I fell out of love with him. And I ended up making the decision that I was going to move to Auckland and do contract work in Auckland and then keep going back to Invercargill and see him. So didn't have any intention of leaving him, of the marriage being over. And then when I moved to Auckland, I joined Get Running, which was a running club, and met all these wonderful runners and started training for my first marathon, which was Auckland Marathon in 2008. And the marathon...
So you were how old then?
I was 42. Yeah. And the day after the marathon, my mother died. And I hadn't had any contact with her for a few years. Just before I moved to New Zealand, I reached out and I met her in London. We went to lunch. I bought her some things and we said goodbye. And I thought that would be the goodbye. I wasn't sure. But when she died, it had much more of an impact than I thought it would.
Really?
I can remember reading, I read an email telling me that she died. My sister had emailed me. With retrospective, phone call would have been better, but it's just the way it worked out at the time. She sent me an email and I was in the office and I read this email and I howled like an animal would howl and I cried. And it took me years to get over it. I think probably because of what I didn't have, you know, there was no bitterness, but I was just really sad for the fact that I hadn't had a good relationship with her. But it made me realise that I didn't want to muck around with the rest of my life in a relationship that I wasn't happy in and doing things I didn't want to do. So split up with my husband and...
You guys didn't have any kids, eh?
No kids. So it was easy.
Was that a choice, or it just didn't work out
that way? Choice. I didn't think I'd be a very good mother, and there was always that danger I could have ended up like my mum, and that would have been awful for kids. And my brother and sisters had kids, so I sort of treated them as my kids, and really fortunate to have great relationships with my nieces and nephews. So yeah. And then also made the decision. I was on this wonderful marathon high after having done my first marathon.
You did all right too, by the way, like 4:20 or something?
I know, 4:20. Yep. That was pretty good. And I was, do you know, the actual time my mother died, I was sitting in a tattoo artist chair getting a tattoo of a rubber duck to commemorate the marathon. So I thought it was only going to be my one ever marathon. And that one in 2008, Adidas had these rubber ducks all over Auckland.
Yeah, that was the campaign that year.
Yeah, they had this massive, massive big plastic rubber duck in Victoria Park. And these posts everywhere and saying, look, be a rubber duck. You can't dent them, they won't sink. So I used to run along and I used to say, I am a little rubber duck, I am a little rubber duck. And even now, times get hard, like if I'm in the chemo chair, I'd be saying to myself, I'm a rubber duck, I can get through this. And I've got this little tattoo of a rubber duck. So I was in the chair when she actually died. So when I found out, I thought, I'm not going to let this define me. I need to do another marathon and I need to keep that high. So I split up from my husband and I carried on marathon training. And with all the lovely friends that I'd made, kept in touch, and they're all still friends now. So it's the running just changed my life. It gave me this huge network of friends, travelling all over the world, and it gave me confidence in my career. I don't think I would have been a director of the company I ended up working for if I hadn't done all the marathons and if that hadn't given me the confidence. And it gave me something to talk about when you go to network events. You know, you go to an event with a room full of accountants and lawyers and bankers. It's not the most exciting area to be in. And I could talk about climbing Kilimanjaro and running a marathon there and running marathons in New York and all this sort of thing.
Antarctica.
It got to the stage Sahara. Where whenever I saw people, potential clients or bankers, the first thing they'd say would be, where have you just been and where are you off to next? And yeah, it's good.
And it was around this time you met Paul, who's sitting in the other room at the moment.
Yeah.
You brought him along as a support person in case you...
I have a seizure because...
Is that a real chance?
Yeah. I had a seizure about a month ago that lasted 40 minutes and it was horrendous. And I could, so the doctor who I saw a couple of weeks ago said, look, you know, I could lose consciousness at any time. And I've got a broken sternum at the moment from the cancer. My spine could break, my neck could break. Or I could have a seizure. And if I have a seizure, there's this medication which would just help me to get out of it really quickly. Because 40 minutes was a long time to be. I was with my sister and her husband and they thought I was dying. It was really awful. So I met Paul in 2009, and just the minute we saw each other, I met him through online dating. We had this date. We met at the Northern Steamship. I don't think it's called that anymore.
Yeah, down Britain that way.
Yeah, that's the one. And I remember walking up towards it, and he was standing outside and thinking, "Ooh, he looks quite nice." And he thought the same of me. And we went for a drink that night, and he said to me, people meet for a reason, a season, or a lifetime.
Yeah.
And I thought, it's a lifetime. I thought, where did that come from? I just wanted a bit of casual fun, and suddenly here I am, having a lifetime. And we've been together ever since, and it's just been the most wonderful relationship. Mm. When COVID hit, and we're suddenly together 24 hours a day, there's not many people that I want to be with for 24 hours, and that I could cope with for 24 hours, and we could. So.
Yeah, oh, that's nice. That's really nice. Did you guys consider getting married at all? Did you discuss it?
No.
Been there, done that, got the T-shirt?
So the marathon I did after Auckland was Paris Marathon in 2010. And he came with to Paris and I said to him, please, if you get any ideas, do not propose to me. The one thing I need you to do is if you love me, never put a ring on it. Because I'd been there. I'd had a marriage thing and it hadn't worked out. I felt no need to have this declaration of love in front of all our friends and family, because everyone who knows me knows how in love we are. And yeah, we're just really happy without it. We don't need it. And I even now, I think, oh God, should I try and quickly do it before I die? But no, I don't need to.
How's he going to be?
Oh yeah, you know, I think he's he's going to be upset, but we've got a really good support network. Mm. And he's seen what I've been through over the last year, the amount of pain that I go through every day, and all the ways my life has changed. You know, it's like, it's the pain, it's the travel, it's the incontinence, it's the not being able to work. I'm just not me anymore. Mm. And so he is completely supportive in the decision that I'm making. And yeah, it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard for a while. I've said to him, I really want him to meet someone else. I don't know if he'll get what we've got again. It'd be lovely if he did. I really want him to meet someone else, but he's got to wait at least 2 weeks.
2 weeks? See, you say you're not you anymore, and I know, like, from a physical perspective, I know you're not, and I know that must be incredibly frustrating. Like, you've got like a walker thing at the moment.
I know. I've had that for a week. Well, that one we just got this morning. But 3 weeks ago, we did a walk around Greylin Park, and it was about 3.5 k's, and he couldn't keep up with me. And then 2 weeks ago, over the weekend, I had a couple of falls, and so we got a walking stick. But then I found the walking stick that I wasn't really well balanced on it. So then a friend of ours had a walker home. She said, well, look, let's try this. And I realised, shit, I do need a walker now. And then today the walker's turned up that's foldable so we can take it everywhere. But the rate of change is crazy.
Yeah. But personality-wise, though, you're the same person.
Yeah.
You've got through this whole thing with a smile on your face.
Oh, I have. And I'm really pleased that I've managed to keep my mental ability, because I didn't know. There's over 30 tumours in my head, and I would
currently
and you think that they'd be pressing against things and maybe changing how I feel. I think I'm probably a bit snappier sometimes than I would be, and not quite as patient, and I've been a bit tearful, but for the most part I'm still me, and I'm able to be eloquent enough to get my opinions across. And yeah, so I'm surprised that I've managed to keep it this long, and hopefully, choosing the date was really difficult, because your inclination is to make it as far out as possible, so you've got as long as possible with the people you love. But it needs to be far enough away that I've got enough time still to do things I want to do. And like, we're heading to Queenstown this weekend, and we're going to Rotorua Marathon next weekend to support our running friends doing the marathon and things like that. So I think the time I've got left is going to be enough time to be able to do what I really want to do. But it needs to be close enough that if my neck suddenly breaks, or if I suddenly lose the chance to be eloquent about things, I can still do the assisting. Because I have to show that I've got the mental capacity to be able to make that decision. I mean, nobody's putting any pressure on me. That's an easy one to comply with. But the doctor has to ask me, do I still want to go ahead with the decision? And I have to, when I say yes, I do, she has to believe that I've got the mental capacity to be able to
decide. Oh, this is at the time of.
Right. So that's why I need to still be able to be me and be normal at the time of.
So if you're feeling like you are now on May 21, you'll push it out or postpone it?
No. I don't want the risk. I could do if I wanted to. The way I'm feeling right now is probably not, because I don't want to risk not being able to do it then. My feel is that by the 22nd of May, I will have done all the things that I want to do, and I'll be ready to go. And I may be in a position that I could hang around for a little bit longer. But what if I made the decision to hang around for another week, and then suddenly my neck broke or something, and I no longer have the mental capacity to be able to say, yes, I want to go ahead with that.
Yeah.
And then I'm faced with having to go in a normal way. And it could still be really quick, but I don't want to risk that.
You what have...
And that's my answer. So I'm having another talk to the doctor this afternoon just to make sure that my understanding of that is absolutely right. But I'm pretty sure I've got it right.
What have oncologists or the experts said in terms of, you know, like time frame and things?
So the first oncologist who I've worked with for 5 years, she had said that she didn't think I would survive past 3 months. Mm-hmm. So when we found that out about 3 weeks ago, and I was thinking, I was locked into that 3 months, think I had 3 months to do stuff. And then the doctor I saw a couple of weeks ago, she's had lots of experience of working with people in my situation, and she said she thought sort of 1 to 2 months and probably focusing on that 1 month. And that made me realise that if I want to do stuff, I just need to get on to it straight away. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's probably where I've been thinking about the 1 month. And you know, I know if I change my mind, if I want to push it out more, I could. And I could also just stop any time. So if I decide, actually, no, this isn't the right way for me, I could just stop. Mm-hmm. There's, yeah, lots of freedom there.
It's nice for you to have some of the control back.
Yes. Yeah, that's the main thing.
Okay. Let's focus on your running for a little bit. So, yeah, first marathon at 42. That's about the same time you met Paul. And you made him run New York? I heard you sort of bullied him around New York.
No, what happened was...
Or he was a lot slower than you.
He was a lot slower than me. And I did. What happened was when we met... So we met in 2009. And he was a swimmer and a cyclist and a tennis player. And I was a runner. I couldn't swim and I couldn't ride a bike. A lot of British people can't swim. It's not particularly unusual. Or ride a bike. Mm. But when I say I can swim, I didn't even want to get in the water. And a few of my friends over the years had tried to teach me to ride a bike, and they'd got me sort of on it in a straight line for a little bit, but I didn't like doing it, so I never practiced, and for all intents and purposes, I could not ride a bike. So we had a deal. I said, if you run a half marathon, I will learn to swim and ride a bike. And the bugger went and did Auckland Half Marathon, so I then didn't have a lot of choice. So then Auckland Council put this thing on for adults to learn to ride a bike, so I learned to ride a bike. And then I went to Tepid Baths and learned to swim, and I did something called the Tri-a-Tri in Takapuna. It was like a 300-meter swim, 9 or 10-kilometer bike ride, and then a 3-kilometer run.
Oh, like a nice entry-level event.
I came last.
It was first, did you? Did yeah, last?
It was so, yeah. But, hey, somebody's got to come last. And I didn't think I was because there was someone behind me, and I thought, yay, I'm come last. And then she was disqualified because she didn't do the whole of the run. But you know, that's all right. So he did a half marathon, and then we both entered for the pole for the you know, where you enter for the Auckland for the New York Marathon.
Oh, the ballot.
For the ballot. Yeah, we entered the ballot for the New York Marathon, and we got in. It's just like incredible. So we went to New York, and he ran his first marathon there, and I ended up doing 49 kilometers because it was really cold, and he hurt himself after about 17k, so he was walking, so I was literally running backwards and forwards and skipping and going side to side. Oh, just trying to keep myself warm.
So annoying.
I was pretending to be a bit of pizza. There's one photo
pretending to be, what do you mean?
Oh, he was desperate for pizza and he thought that would help him through, so I was like, just pretend I'm pizza, come on, you can do this. And then at the end of the race, I went back to the hotel room and I went and got him ice, I got him pizza. I was back and forwards everywhere, bringing him all this stuff. But he did ever so well. He did it. And then that set him off on a running career. And, you know, he's just as much a runner as he's done, like, 6 marathons, and he's done a 100-kilometre race. So, yeah, he's a great runner.
Mm. Oh, good team, eh?
Yeah.
And some of the running stuff. So we mentioned at the beginning the World Marathon Majors, which you've got a 6-star finishing medal for. And there's something quite nice about that. Like when you go to any one of those events, they have like an honours board, and your name's going to be on that wall forever.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool, I think.
And at the moment, so I've got a friend who did Tokyo Marathon. Lisa did Tokyo Marathon, and she sent me the picture of my name on the board, which was really cool. Mm. And I've got another friend who's just done London Marathon, and she sent me the picture of my name on the board. So I'm going to, yeah.
That's kind of nice. And yeah, so the World Marathon Majors, the number of people in that group is fairly small, but an even smaller group is people that have run marathons on all 7 continents, which you have done. Were you the first, second woman in New Zealand?
No, third. So Jo was second. So my friend Jo, she's an ophthalmologist, and she's a runner. And we met in 2009, I think, we started running together. And we found we were the same sort of pace, we got on well. And so we started running, doing our training together. And then we were both looking for more from running than just entering a race. I think we wanted something that would have be a real goal. I think she was the one who found it, that there was this thing running a marathon on every continent. So we thought, well, we'd done a couple already. Let's work towards that. And we entered for the Kilimanjaro marathon. And then we thought, well, we're there, we might as well climb Kilimanjaro because it would be a bit rude not to. And so we
go all
so
that way.
Yeah. And we ran a marathon together in Mongolia. And we did the Antarctica marathon. And she entered it first, and then I'd entered it for the year after, but then she changed and we ran it together. And so when we did the Antarctica marathon, that was our seventh continent. And she was faster than me, so I maintained she was the second woman in New Zealand to do it, and I was the third.
Wow. But just doing it. You know, 99.9% of people will never go to Antarctica, let alone go there and run a fucking marathon. Like, it's cool, eh?
Yeah.
It's really cool.
It is.
And Marathon de Sable as well, which is very niche. Most people won't even know what this is, but this is like a sand race, like a stage race. Tell us about that event.
It's Pete's fault. So when we... Pete's fault. Take some responsibility
for your actions, Tracy.
No. When we did Kilimanjaro, we stayed in this little bed and breakfast that was owned by a Kiwi. And maybe because it was owned by a Kiwi, there was another guy there. It was a Kiwi guy from Invercargill called Pete. And... he told us he was going to celebrate his 60th birthday by running the Marathon de Sable. I'd never even heard of it.
Yeah.
But how small is New Zealand? Talking to Pete, we realised his wife, when I left Invercargill, his wife had taken my job. The chances of
that. Wow.
So anyway, so we didn't know each other before this time. So he was telling us about this Marathon de Sable, and we thought, oh, actually it sounds quite interesting. It's 250 kilometres in the Sahara Desert, and you have to yourself sort of, I can't think what the word is, but we had to carry all our gear.
Yeah, carry your own, so everything you eat.
We had to, everything we eat, our sleeping bags, and then they put you in a tent. But it's not a tent, it's a bit of blanket with some wooden sticks, that's your tent.
Like a canopy sort of thing.
So you're allocated to a tent by country. So we were four Kiwis and two Aussies in our tent, I think. But we had two elites in our tent, which was quite cool. And... so he told us about it, and we said, oh, yeah, we'll do that with you. But that it was like 2015 we met, and it was 2018 he wanted to do it. We thought it was ages away. And then in 2016, he messaged us, and he said, right, it's open, I'm entered. And I thought, oh, brother, I'm not sure I actually want to do it now. And then Joe entered, and they were sending each other messages saying, is she entered yet? And Joe's like, oh, no. And I'm like, I am here, you know, and no, I don't think I'm going to do it. And then... I was interviewed for the Antarctica Marathon. There was a stuff article because I was doing it as a fundraiser. And they said, what's next? And I said, oh, I'm not sure. I'm thinking about maybe doing Marathon de Sable. And when they sent me the blurb to read to proof check it, they'd written, and her next race is Marathon de Sable. And I thought, well, I can either call them and get them to change that to she's maybe thinking about it, or I can just enter it. So I quickly entered it on the spot and sent them back and said, yeah, it's all good. And I remember Paul reading it saying, yeah, she says you've actually entered. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I might have done that this afternoon. So we trained together, three of us trained together.
How do you train for that?
I had a client and they had this massive freezer, the industrial-sized freezer. And so we put all our gear on and we went in the freezer to run up and down the shelves to make sure that our gear that we could... he took it down to minus 20 degrees and got the fan on. So that we could make sure our gear was cold.
Oh, off the Antarctica one.
Oh, that's the Antarctica one. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow. No, so, oh, no, I didn't even think about that. Wow.
Oh, yeah. No, and training for Marathon de Sable saunas. So we were training in the summer. We put really warm clothes on. And we went to Bethel's Beach and Tauhanga and training on the sand there. We trained in saunas. I was at the tepid baths in their steam room in their sauna with all my gear on.
And just, oh my God, they must have looked ridiculous.
Yeah, it'd be crazy. and lots of back to back. So you've got to do 250 kilometres over a week, and it's a stage race. So you do like 30k one day, 35k the next. The longest day is 87. So I actually entered the Tarawera 87 race so that I knew I could do 87 because that was a big mental thing for me. But a lot of our training would be doing three or four runs in a row, you know, 3 or 4 days in a row, or running morning and evening to build up that stamina. We had our feet needed to be really tough because of the blisters. So we bought this stuff called Tough Foot that is used on horses and dogs to toughen their feet. And so you put this stuff on your feet and it gives you this really hard skin. I was like, awesome. You know, you could walk barefoot on gravel and not feel it. And the food, because you had to have 2,000 calories a day and you had to make sure that, you know, you could, that the food was going to be palatable. So I remember one night, Joe and I both, we'd bought all these different sorts of dehydrated foods. And we got Paul over and we had a dinner party with all these foods. And I remember, are you still having Radix Nutrition?
Yeah, Radix, yeah, I love it.
We had some Radix food there. But I think it was not long after they'd started and they had this pea thing, this like mushy peas. It was gross, it was absolutely gross. I think that's the only one that none of us could eat. But some of the Radix stuff was delicious and there was some really lovely French food as well. So yeah, we worked out what food we could have. We had to get these like suction thing in case we got bit by scorpions, so that you could take the bite out. So sting things. I mean the training was. So there's lots of books written about it. There's documentaries on it. I had a coach, James Kugler was my coach. Did a fantastic job coaching me on it. I didn't do everything he told me to, but we built a relationship whereby. You know, he'd say, I really think you should do this. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. And he was like, okay, maybe try this. And we'd negotiate and find a way through.
And you got through it. And I think all of these running events paint a picture of the sort of person you are, like just how tough you are and how resilient you are. Have the lessons that you learned from doing these physically tough things helped you in dealing with the pain and discomfort that
comes with cancer? Yeah, absolutely. Because I know Marathon du Sable was such a tough thing to do. And while I was doing it, I got ill while I was out there. I got an infection, and so I had to deal with that as well on top of everything else. And when I had to deal with cancer, I thought, I can do this. I've run in the desert. I've done marathons everywhere. When I did the marathon in Mongolia, I got food poisoning the night before. I stopped throwing up at 10 o'clock, and the alarm went off at 2 to get up and run this race. It took me 10 and a half hours to do the marathon. I was just in such a bad place, but I did it. And so all that stuff shows you, yeah, you can, all you've got to do is be strong enough to suck it up. Pain is weakness leaving the body, and you know, all those little mantras to yourself, and just do it. So I never had any doubt that I could get through the treatment. What I don't like is where I've ended up. Like, I think one of the biggest ones is not being able to travel, and it's so wrong. There's a problem in New Zealand. If I lived in Australia or in the UK with stage 4 cancer, I could get travel insurance with medical cover, even with stage 4 cancer. And if I had that, I wouldn't be here right now. I'd be in Croatia or Costa Rica or Chile or the Stans, all these places that I still wanted to go to. But in New Zealand, we cannot get travel insurance for stage 4 cancer patients. You could up until COVID hit. And then when COVID hit, the one company that was doing it pulled out. And that's wrong. That's really wrong. I contacted the companies that do it in Australia and the UK. I said, look, I've got contacts in the insurance industry here from my professional career. Can I help you set up over here? There are people who want to do it. It could be lucrative. We're willing to pay a lot of money for travel insurance. But you can't do that. And that's one of the toughest things, not being able to travel.
You showed me something yesterday, which I actually found this quite upsetting as well, even though it's a beautiful thing. And it's just an example of the profound impact that you've had on the running circles that you move in. The blanket that was given to you as a gift.
Oh, my
rag, yeah. How do you describe that?
It's So it's a quilt. One of the women in our running club does a wonderful job of quilting, Jennifer. And she made a quilt of everybody contributed a T-shirt that was important to them, or a medal ribbon, or a buff, some piece of material that was important to them. And she's put them all together in a massive quilt with a blanket on the back. And then there's actually a letter on the back that they've all signed. And they've said, it's from our running club for me to feel that they're with me when times get tough. And for the last couple of weeks, pretty much every night, I wake up at about 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And when I wake up at that time, I'm always in pain, and I have a little cry just to let the emotion out and get it out of my system a bit. And I take morphine, and the morphine makes me cold. So I put that blanket on me, and I just feel like everyone's hugging me. It's so special. And so for the last year, that blanket has been giving me comfort. And the
it's the really cool. Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's absolutely beautiful. And the treatment over the last year has been tough, has been really tough. But that blanket has helped me through a lot of it. And my cat loves it as well. So he comes on it when we snuggle up together. Mm. And yeah, it's pretty special.
So that waking up in the middle of the night and having a little cry, are you crying because of frustration, because of the pain, or just like sadness because of your situation? Or
yeah, partly the pain, but then when I take the pain relief 20 minutes later, you know, I'm feeling okay again. Mainly the frustration at just how has my life changed this much? Like a year ago I was running Boston Marathon and now I'm making preparations to die, and I hate that it's going to have such an impact on all the people who love me. In the last few weeks, I went to the UK in March, and in 3.5 weeks I said goodbye to over 54 people, all in really important people in my life. And again, very privileged that I had the opportunity to do that. But that's 54 people who I'm going to be hurting because of what's going to happen in a few weeks' time. And I'm going through it here now. There's a lot of people here who I'm saying goodbye to, and some people I'm going to have the chance to see again in the next few weeks. And some people, when I see them, I'm like, I'm sorry, this is the last time we're going to see each other. So we have a hug. And when I wake up in the early hours, that's, you know, I think about who I've said goodbye to that day or who I'm going to be seeing the next day, and the impact I'm having on them. But one good thing is, because I'm originally from the UK, I've got a lot of family, friends and family over there. So then I get on the phone and I've got two nieces, Tracy and Kelly, and they've been awesome.
Mm.
They, at that time of day, they've pretty much just got home, brought their kids home from school, got themselves a cup of tea. We get on the phone and we get giggling. And within 10 minutes of being on the phone, they've got me laughing, telling me stories, we're reminiscing, and it all feels okay again.
Yeah.
I can get through it.
So March 2019, you want us to us through that period? So you go for a routine mammogram.
Yeah,
You're not feeling unwell or anything.
No,
it's just a
no. The only thing I had since in 2018, so I ran Marathon de Sable in 2018, and then I trained for my first 100-kilometer race. And as part of that training, I did quite a lot of strength training, and I had some pain in my chest, and I thought I'd pulled a muscle with all the strength training. So that's the only thing. And my routine mammogram was due in about the October that year, but my sister was going through getting diagnosed with Parkinson's. We didn't know at that time that that's what it was. But she had lots of pain. She was going through lots of CT scans and things. So I was really thinking about her, and I thought, I just can't cope with another scan result right now. So I'm just going to put it off for a month or two. And then I kept getting reminders saying, you must come for the scan. So I went for my routine scan. And I did it privately. So went for the scan at 8:30 in the morning. 2 hours later at 10:30, I'd come out and I'd had a scan, a second scan, a biopsy, an ultrasound, and had a breast surgeon talking to me about mastectomy.
Mm.
In 2 hours. I had nobody else there. I was there by myself. And I was just shell-shocked, absolutely shell-shocked. I walked out of there and burst into tears. And I drove, it was near Mount Eden, and I drove to the car park at Mount Eden. And I sat there in the car and I thought, oh my God. How is this? My sister had breast cancer in 2015. I had a good friend who had it in 2013, another good friend who had it in 2017. So I had three people in my life who'd had it, and I'd been their support. I thought, how the hell am I going to tell them? How the hell am I going to tell Paul? How am I going to tell my sister? I just sat there and thought, this can't be happening. Mm. And then I drove home, and Paul came home, and that was the start of the where we're at now. And I remember sending an email to our managing partner at work and saying, so I've got breast cancer, but I think I'm just going to be able to have a little operation. I might be off for 2 weeks. you know, we probably don't need to tell that many people, and I should still be able to keep working in the background. And then on the Monday, found out that I'd need chemotherapy and it was actually going to be longer than a couple of weeks. And it's just been downhill from there.
Do you think of the biggest lessons or surprises that you've learned about yourself in the face of this unimaginable adversity?
Well, I think I always knew that I was tough. I'm probably a bit tougher than I thought I was.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm.
And I didn't realise how many people I've got in my life who love me. It's the last couple of weeks, we've all started voicing it and telling each other how much we love each other. And even like, you know, people who've, in a working, in a professional environment, you don't tell your colleagues you love each other.
Never.
But, you know, I had a young lad who worked for me for quite a few years, and he was my right-hand person. I did well in my job because of his help. And we told each other we loved each other. And it's really special. It's actually voicing it. Mm. I just didn't realise how much of that. And I didn't realise what an impact I'd made on other people's lives.
Mm. Yeah, one thing I've noticed, we've been talking for 48 minutes now, and something that you've mentioned a few times is just almost like the guilt or the sadness you feel about how other people are going to feel once you're gone. It's very selfless.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, if I could have started over my career, I would have chosen to be a nurse or a policewoman or something like that, where I could have been helping people, because that's what I would have loved to do. I ended up in a career where I ended up helping people anyway, with, you know, helping their businesses survive and that sort of thing. But I've always, wherever I've worked, I've gravitated towards mentoring the young ones.
Yeah.
My clients and young ones at work often call me Auntie Tracy, and just being there for people. Maybe it's because I didn't grow up with a situation where I had a really loving family. I mean, my sister has always been incredibly loving and looked after me, but I missed out on having family looking after me like in that way.
Mm.
So maybe that's why. But being able to care for other people and love other people is something really important to me.
Yeah, you've done so much bucket list stuff, like some of those runs. Your bucket list for a lot of people listening to this or watching this would sound like their nightmare. But you've done so much stuff that's, I guess, on your bucket list. Is there anything that you really wanted to do that you're not going to get the chance to?
Yeah, the countries to go to. I would have loved to go to Machu Picchu and to Croatia. I would have, if I hadn't been ill. So Joe, my running friend, has gone on. She's done the Mila at Tarawera.
Wow. Mila, by the way, 100 miles. So it's 100 like 160 miles. Ks.
And when she did the 100K, she did it in 17 hours and it took me 24 hours. We used to run together all the time. If I hadn't had cancer, I would have probably been closer to her in 17 hours. So that's the impact that the cancer had on me. And I couldn't hope to do a Mila. I would have loved to have done a Mila. And I've got a good friend, Rachel, who's going to be doing the Mila next year. And we had dinner this week and we were both crying about the fact that she's going to have to do it by herself. And I would have done it with her. And that hurts, knowing that I can't help her through that. Hopefully she's going to feel that I'm with her, you know, but hey. So yeah, doing a Mila would have been a really awesome thing.
Mm.
And seeing just being part of friends' lives, seeing them achieve things.
And yeah, like a FOMO, seeing the little FOMO ones aspect
grow,
in a way.
Yeah, seeing the little ones grow up. You know, I've got 4-year-old and 8-year-old great nieces and 15-year-old and couple of 17-year-olds. Seeing them meet people, have children, get married, make success of their careers, all of that, miss out on all of that.
Yeah, just life moving on, I guess.
And growing old with Paul, you know, we had plans to grow old together. And I always said to him, like, I wanted to be with him for 50 years, and we were 42 when we met, so that was going to be a bit of a stretch. But I said, when we're in our early hundreds, like 105, 106, and we've had enough, we are going to go out with a splash. Because I said, I wanted to get in a helicopter, and I wanted to go over a volcano, and I was going to push him out and then jump in after him. he's always been
a very extreme murder suicide.
Yeah, yeah. He's always been a bit scared of that. So this weekend we're going to Queenstown. He's never been in a helicopter before. We're going to Queenstown, and we're doing a helicopter ride. And I think he's excited about it now. I think in a normal situation I probably wouldn't have got him in there, because I think he's always thought about my threat of the volcano. Wouldn't that be a way to go, though?
Oh my God, very dramatic. That's
although apparently we went to Sydney last weekend, and we caught up with some friends to say goodbye over there, and they said it was physically not possible that I wouldn't have been able to push him out of the helicopter because of the aerodynamics of it or whatever. So my plan wouldn't have worked anyway.
I don't know. I feel like if there was a way to do it, you'd figure it out. are you still well enough to enjoy these things in the last few weeks?
Like the trip to Queenstown? I mean, Sydney, we were really lucky. We went to Bondi and we spent the day in Bondi. It was the day before the awful events of Bondi. But we spent a whole day at this beach club. It's like a bit like an RSA.
Oh, icebergs.
Yeah, that's it, icebergs.
Yeah, with a swimming pool.
Yeah, not the flash bit. No, the bit one. Where you can just go and have fish and chips and stuff. We spent about 4 or 5 hours there, and it was lovely. Mm. So, yeah, enjoyed that. And in Queenstown, we're going to go to a nice restaurant, book some nice accommodation, going to enjoy the... When we go to Rotorua next weekend for the marathon, we're going to see our friends do the marathon, and a big group of us are going to go to that new spa that's opened up on the waterfront. So I'm hoping we're going to enjoy that. So I can go along and enjoy these things. In the background, there's always a level of pain. And I also have to just manage my energy levels. I still forget that life has changed and that I can't do what I think I can do. So a lot of it is sort of Paul saying to me, come on, I think you need to take a lie down or take a break.
Yeah, cause as someone that's been...
And also the steroids. Oh, my gosh. The steroids are having an impact on me and are speeding me up. No business. We were in the supermarket on Wednesday and he was like, can we stop? I need you to slow down. I feel a bit guilty that I'm making him do that.
Oh, my God. Yeah, cause you're not even a coffee drinker.
No.
Yeah, steroids. Are you scared? Do you have any fears?
I'm a little bit scared just of something going wrong, of the control freak in me not being able to get it to go exactly as I want it to go. The actual death itself, I don't think I am anymore. I think I've reached a place where I think if it's as gentle as they say it's gonna be, and you know, it's 2 or 3 minutes. Even if that is 2 or 3 minutes of pain, that's not long to have to deal with. But by all accounts, that's not gonna be a really painful thing. And I'm just going to be with all the people I really love. And, you know, so no, I don't think I am scared anymore.
I think I read somewhere that the last thing that goes is in terms of your senses is your hearing.
Yeah. So it's a bit ironic, really, since the chemo destroyed my hearing.
All right.
So I was, you know, what are the chances? When I had my first dose of chemo, I got a very large dose and it took away a huge part of my hearing. So I have hearing aids now. So there's something like 46,000 people around the world had the same treatment as me. 23 had lost their hearing. And I was number 24. Yeah. So chance that. So yes, I do have enough hearing left that hopefully I will still be able to hear. But the hearing is the last thing. So hopefully I'll still be able to hear the sea and I'll be able to hear whatever my family are saying.
Mm. And so you'll be on... Because I don't know, it's probably not something I gave a lot of thought to, but I just assumed people that chose to die this way would be maybe in a bed at home or in a hospice or in a clinic or somewhere. But you can do it anywhere. So yeah, you're choosing a beach.
Yeah, I don't know about anywhere, but I know...
Within reason.
So the doctor mentioned that you could do it in a garden or a park or a beach, and I straight away homed in on the beach and thought that would be really good. Beaches are very meaningful to me, and I thought that would be a lovely place to be. Mm. Now, I don't know the exact, you know, whether I'm going to be sitting on a rug or on a chair or how we're going to make it work. I think we've chosen the beach. We're really lucky. We met one of my former clients on Monday, and they suggested a beach that's very close to their home where they got married. And my first thought was like, oh, you can't do that. I don't want you to be looking at that beach all the time and thinking that's where I died. And they said, no, you're getting this wrong way. We'd see it as an honour if you did it there. So I'm thinking, I haven't actually been there yet, so we need to go up and have a look. But I'm thinking that might be the place. And, yeah, maybe getting some nice chairs set up at gazebo if it's raining and just be together holding hands. Yeah, I haven't put a lot of thought into how it's going to work. I wanted to have that conversation with the doctor this afternoon to make sure that the timing and the location is going to work before I invest too much energy into it. So I didn't want to get all well, not excited, excited is the wrong word, to get, you know, to get it all clear in my mind about how it's going to be, and then to find that I can't do that. I don't want to die at home. I don't, we live in a lovely old villa in Grey Lynn, and there's no plan to sell it, and I don't want Paul to have those memories of me dying at home. I don't think that would be a good thing. So if it can't be there, then it would be in a hospice. Mm. And there is a hospice where you're allowed to do assisted death. So, yeah. So if I can't do it anywhere else, then that's where it would be. But yeah. Hopefully we can get the beach to work.
And music playing or anything? You have a Bluetooth speaker?
I hadn't thought about that. I mean, yeah, I could have a bit of the Czechs Ready to Die, maybe.
Oh my God!
Is that wrong?
Hey,
I wouldn't go with Staying Alive because that would be a bit too. Yeah. I love Queens of the Stone Age, and there is a Queens of the Stone Age song saying, "I'm gonna leave you." So yeah, I have to put a bit of thought into that.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe no music. Actually, the more I'm talking to you, maybe I'm thinking no music.
And yeah, it might be quite nice. I just the sound of the waves crashing and And any regrets or anything you'd do differently?
There's a couple of things I've done in my life that I do differently that I probably don't want to go into, but just thinking, I don't know if any of us go through our whole life, but for the most part, even for those things, one of those I've apologised, and for the most part, I think I've been true to my values. And just trying to treat people in a good way, in the same way that I'd want to be treated.
Yeah.
I wish my relationship with my mum had been different. And it's not a regret on my side. And I don't know if there's anything I could have done to make it different. I think Dad needed to be stronger. And she would have needed some help with the mental health issues. And that maybe she could have been, and you know, for want of a better word, normal mother. But then my whole life could have been really different. Mm. If that had happened, I might not be the strong person that I am. And I might have just ended up living a really normal, boring, ordinary life. And as it is, I've lived such a full life. I've had so many adventures. And I think I'm grateful for the fact that I've had those. So, and even my marriage, you know, the marriage didn't work out, but we're both really happy now with new partners. He's got a couple of kids, and we're still in touch, not on a regular basis, but just, you know, the odd once or twice a year an email. He knows, he doesn't know the full extent, you know, that I'm going to be dying in a couple of weeks' time, but he knows that it's come back.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, I can hold my head up high when I look at how that's turned out.
Yeah, that's cool. And you've buried any hatchets that you feel you needed to bury?
Well, I've got a brother he's a half brother, so we share the same mother but not the same father. And his wife passed away in October, and he reached out to me when his wife passed away. I think he probably realised that he was going to be lonely because she looked after him for nearly 30 years. And I met up with him when I went to the UK. We only met up for about an hour or so, and it felt like meeting a stranger. He's a lot older than me, and I realised I don't really know him. But I'm glad I met with him, because I could walk away and think, well, look, I did that. I met with him. I realised that he's not this person who I've got heaps in common with, who I wanted to spend lots of time with. I don't regret the fact that I didn't spend lots of time with him over the years. And I said goodbye, and, yeah, I think... There's probably anyone. I've got another sister. So I always talk about my sister, my one sister. We do have another sister. She also has those mental health issues. And we, for self-preservation, we're not in touch with her.
Yeah.
She's done some really awful things. And I have no regrets about that at all. And I'm absolutely fine with the fact that she's not in my life. I think it's a better life for it. So, yeah.
Yeah. What about the afterlife? Are you an atheist? Are you?
Yeah, I don't believe in God. I don't know what's going to happen. Increasingly, I'm thinking maybe there'll be a bit of spirit or something. Maybe people will feel I'm with them. I've got one niece who does a lot of work in Antarctica. I took her to Antarctica with me when I did the marathon. And she ended up, she was a zookeeper and she looked after gorillas and she ended up changing her ears so that she's now a guide in Antarctica. Wow. And she said often she'll take necklaces with her and her necklace will move. And or she, I can't remember the exact story. I think she read that like a necklace can be moved by someone. And so we have this deal that if she sees her necklace moving, it means I'm with her and I've moved her necklace for her.
So, oh, that's cool. Like little signs.
Yeah. But for the most part, no. I don't.
Once you're gone, you're gone, like a computer?
Yeah, I think once you're gone, you're gone. I mean, I've got a few friends who believe in reincarnation. And if that is a thing, I would love to come back as something really caring.
Like a Jessica, perhaps.
A Jessica, yeah, yeah. Be a Jessica.
Yeah. What are some things that you thought were important, but now you realise they weren't?
Oh, stuff. My God, I've spent the last year getting rid of stuff. Shoes. I had 104 pairs of shoes. That's not including boots or running shoes. That's just, you know, dress shoes. And the amount of stuff that I had, I've given it all to charity shops. The running gear I had, I've given a lot of that to my fellow runners. And that's been a nice thing because they've said that they're going to think about me when they wear it when they run. But all that other stuff, it's just crazy. And I think we forget how important relationships are. Over the last few months, the amount of lovely time I've spent with people where we've been really truthful in expressing our feelings for each other, telling each other we love each other, how much we care for each other, and having a special time. And just recently, because I'm so tired, a lot of the time when people come around, I'm like, can we just sit on the sofa and snuggle and just have a cuddle and just talk? And we don't do enough of that. There's this emphasis on going to flash restaurants and doing stuff. Life doesn't have to be about that. It can be about just being together.
Have you always been good with this stuff and quite communicative, or has it sort of been accelerated?
Oh, no, I think I've been pretty good. Yeah. I have ended up with a huge number of friends. Staying in touch with people has always been important. I've been quite good at communication, I think. So I've moved around a lot. This address now is my 40th address. And despite moving everywhere, I've made sure that I've kept in touch with people I've worked with or been friends with. And that's why there's this huge process now of trying to see everyone and say goodbye to everyone. But I think the communication, telling people how I feel about them, might be one of the reasons, one of the ways that I've managed to develop such deep friendships.
Mm. Yeah. How would you like to be remembered?
Hopefully as someone who made a difference in people's lives.
Mm.
I don't know. Is that a bit too big? Boastful?
Well, no, it's your story. It seems like you feel embarrassed about saying that out loud.
I was just, as I was saying that, I thought, oh, gosh, that's probably a bit too tall poppy.
Well, geez, if you can't say it a few weeks out from your death, when can you say it?
Yeah, I
think that's a very, very reasonable expectation of how to be remembered.
Yeah.
I had a guy around the other day, a guy called Dougal Allen, who's like a multi-sport legend, and he's currently in Team New Zealand. He did one of those God Zone events a few years ago with Richie McCaw and his team.
Oh, yeah.
And he said during one of the nights, like night three or night four or whatever of this 5-day event, they come up with little games to try and keep each other awake. And Richie McCaw asked everyone on the team three words for how they'd like to be described at their funeral. Can you think of three words?
Oh, gosh. Sprung that one on me, didn't you? Not one to spring on someone with chemo brain. friendly. I'd like everyone to think, because I've always tried to be friendly to make people feel really welcome, so friendly. This is going to be wrong. Loving, because I feel I've had a lot of love for people. And hopefully they've really felt that love. And stubborn.
Because why was that not the first one?
Because I am stubborn as a mule. I've said before, you can dress it up as determined or whatever, but there's no dress up. It is stubborn. And if I get my mind set on something, it will happen. Paul always laughs. I say to him, all you've got to do is express the slightest interest in want to do something. And the minute he says it, it's like, helicopter ride in Queenstown, it's booked, flights are booked, hotels booked, everything. It's like, I'm going to make things happen.
Mm. Yeah, you do. You're a go-getter.
Yeah.
And that's the tragedy and the crime of this whole thing. It's like, you started running in your 40s. When you got the diagnosis, you were the fittest you'd ever been in your life.
Yeah, you know,
the top 1% of fitness for people in your early 50s.
That's
and
right.
This should be the time of your life where you're coming into your own, you know.
And I want a legacy from this. Like, what are the good things that come out of it? Well, when I went through cancer first time round and all my treatment, I did some articles that were on Stuff about the importance of exercise and cancer. Mm. Because I think people are scared of going out and exercising when they're going through cancer treatment, but it's so important, so important. A lot of the oncologists and medical people I've spoken to have said, if you could put exercise in a pill, it would be such a dramatic change for people's cancer patients. Mm. Well, now I feel, because I want to be really open about the decisions I've made about going through the assisted death, then maybe I could have a bit of a legacy in helping people understand that, A, that it is a thing. There's still people who don't realise it's legal in New Zealand. That it's coming up for review at the end of the year to make sure that it definitely gets through again. But to get people talking about it, because it was really hard. When I was going through, I'm lucky at the moment, the Guardian newspaper in Australia and in the UK has had a whole series of articles about assisted death, about ways to do it, like getting the whole family together rather than just being one person and a doctor, of getting people together and having it as a bit of a celebration of your life to go rather than being this secretive thing. Getting people talking about it. And if by being public about this now, I can get someone else talking about it, talking to their family about it, or someone else considering it as an option, as something that they're willing to voice out loud, then I think it's worth it.
Yeah. Oh, you're a good advocate. Why do you think it is so controversial?
I think because people link it with suicide, and it's not. Suicide, in my way of thinking, I think suicide can be a really tragic thing where people are ill, people who are committing suicide are ill, and it's not a choice that they're necessarily making. But assisted death is actually a real privilege, and it's a way to take control back. When you get cancer or you get a disease, your control is taken away from you, and you lose a part of yourself. And to be able to be given that control back is huge. And to be able to make decisions, to be able to die in a painless way with people you love, well, you know, I think people often say, we do that for animals, you know, if our animals start to die. I don't think it's, you know, it's a really good comparison, but yeah, I don't necessarily want to
shoot you if you break a leg.
Yeah, yeah. But
I know what you mean.
But it is, you know, we wouldn't let an animal go through immense pain, and yet in some countries humans are. And why is it such a battle? We have a right to life. Why don't we have a right to death?
Yeah, also you're an incredibly proud person, so if you want to leave and be remembered a certain way, then I think that's your decision.
Yeah, exactly.
What would your message be for anyone watching this who is not staring death in the face but is perhaps not living their life to the full?
Oh, do something every day that makes you happy. That's something that I've done pretty much for the last 5 years since I got diagnosed. And sometimes that's something that makes me happy is going and having ice cream or have a bit of chocolate. But sometimes it's do something nice for somebody else or going to, you know, ticking off that bucket list. I'm lucky because of the career that I've had that I've had enough money to be able to tick off the bucket list. Not everybody does, but it doesn't mean you still can't, you know, go for a nice walk or something. So it doesn't have to be expensive stuff. It's being true to yourself, but doing more things that make us happy. I think that's something that's really important that not enough of us do. Yeah. And being really honest with the people in your life.
And what would your final words or message be for people who love you? So something that they can come back and watch or listen to, you know, whenever they want, whenever they're having a sad day.
I'm so sorry that this has happened, that I'm leaving them. I really am. I love them all so much, so much. And I'm gutted to be leaving them. It's too soon. I want another 50 years with them. But I don't want another 50 years of me just sitting there existing. I need to do it on my own terms. I've got to do this now. I know it's the right thing for me. They all know it's the right thing for me. It doesn't make it easy. For my sister, particularly Linda, I love her so much. And it's just, I hate what I see this is doing to her. But we've got to do it. And we love each other enough. I think, you know, it's that, what's the song, if you love someone, set them free. And she knows, she loves me enough that she knows this is the right thing for me. And Paul, yeah, just, I'm so sorry.
Is there anything else? Anything else that we haven't touched upon today that you'd like to?
No, I think we've covered a pretty wide area. You know, on the day itself, I'm going to have a relatively small group of people with me, but I've got time in the lead up. As much as I can, I'm happy to answer questions, get people talking about it, to try to help people going through the situation, because I know I need to be careful in how I spend my energy, and I want to spend as much time as I can with the people who are really important to me. But if I can do something to raise the awareness more, I think that would be a really good thing. And it may be that I could have a big impact by doing an interview, an article or something, rather than talking to lots of different people. But yeah, that would be awesome. Yeah.
Well, Tracy Hickman.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk to you, because I reached out to your mum to say, hey, can we do something like this? And I was thinking of it as being just something for my family to have. I didn't think it'd be enough information for it to be commercial and of interest for your actual podcast. But yeah, thank you. Thank you for giving me the chance to do this.
Oh, no, you're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity to do it. I mean, yeah, death is one of the certainties of life, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's something we're all going to face, yet it's something that we're all terrified of, and it's kind of taboo to talk about it in a way. So thank you for shining a torch in particular on the assisted dying thing.
Yeah,
Tracy Hickman, it's been a fabulous life, way too short, but I hope it's a fabulous death as well, because you deserve nothing less.
Thank you.
Witness history at Roland Garros, where old rivalries meet new talent on the clay battleground. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled access as the world's top players in tennis face off to see if the veterans maintain their dominance or if a fresh face rises to challenge them. Daily live coverage of the French Open begins Monday, May 20th. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.